explored, we will also have put our planet in order. We will have the will and the resources and the technical knowledge to go to the stars. We will have examined from great distances the diversity of other planetary systems, some very much like our own and some extremely different. We will know which stars to visit. Our machines and our descendants will then skim the light years, the children of Thales and Aristarchus, Leonardo and Einstein. We are not yet certain how many planetary systems there are, but there seem to be a great abundance. In our immediate vicinity, there is not just one, but in a sense, four. Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus each has a satellite system that, in the relative sizes and spacings of the moons, resembles closely the planets about the sun. Extrapolation of the statistics of double stars, which are greatly disparate in mass, suggests that almost all single stars, like the sun, should have planetary companions. We cannot yet directly see the planets of other stars, tiny points of light swamped in the brilliance of their local suns. But we are becoming able to detect the gravitational influence of an unseen planet on an observed star. Imagine such a star with a large, proper motion, moving over decades against the backdrop of more distant constellations, and with a large planet, the mass of Jupiter, say, whose orbital plane is by chance aligned at right angles to our line of sight. When the dark planet is, from our perspective, to the right of the star will be pulled a little to the right, and conversely, when the planet is to the left. Consequently, the path of the star will be altered or perturbed from a straight line to a wavy one. The nearest star for which this gravitational perturbation method can be applied is Barnard's star, the nearest single star. The complex interactions of the three stars in the Alpha Centauri system would make the search for a low-mass companion there very difficult. Even for Barnard's star, the investigation must be painstaking. A search for microscopic displacements of position on photographic plates exposed at the telescope over a period of decades. Two such quests have been performed for planets around Barnard's star, and both have been, by some criteria, successful, implying the presence of two or three planets of Jovian mass moving in an orbit, calculated by Kepler's third law, somewhat closer to their star than Jupiter and Saturn are to the Sun. But unfortunately, the two sets of observations seem mutually incompatible. A planetary system around Barnard's star may well have been discovered, but an unambiguous demonstration awaits further study. Other methods of detecting planets around the stars are under development, including one where the obscuring light from the star is artificially occulted with a disk in front of a space telescope or by using the dark edge of the moon as such a disk and the reflected light from the planet, no longer hidden by the brightness of the nearby star, emerges. In the next few decades, we should have definite answers to which of the 100 nearest stars have large planetary companions. In recent years, infrared observations have revealed a number of likely pre-planetary disc-shaped clouds of gas and dust around some of the nearby stars. Meanwhile, some provocative theoretical studies have suggested that planetary systems are a galactic commonplace. A set of computer investigations has examined the evolution of a flat, condensing disc of gas and dust of the sort that is thought to lead to stars and planets. Small lumps of matter, the first condensations in the disk, are injected at random times into the cloud. The lumps accrete dust particles as they move. When they become sizable, they also gravitationally attract gas, mainly hydrogen, in the cloud. When two moving lumps collide, the computer program makes them stick. The process continues until all the gas and dust has been in this way used up. The results depend on the initial conditions, particularly on the distribution of gas and dust density with the distance from the center of the cloud. But for a range of plausible initial conditions, planetary systems, about 10 planets, terrestrials close to the star, Jovians on the exterior, recognizably like ours, are generated. Under other circumstances, there are no planets, just a smattering of asteroids, or there may be Jovian planets near the star, or a Jovian planet may accrete so much gas and dust as to become a star, the origin of a binary star system. It is still too early to be sure, but it seems that a splendid variety of planetary systems is to be found throughout the galaxy, and with high frequency. All stars must come, we think, from such clouds of gas and dust. There may be 100 billion planetary systems in the galaxy awaiting exploration. Not one of those worlds will be identical to Earth. A few will be hospitable, most will appear hostile, many will be achingly beautiful. In some worlds, there will be many suns in the daytime sky, many moons in the heavens at night, or great particle ring systems soaring from horizon to horizon. Some moons will be so close that their planet will loom high in the heavens, covering half the sky. And some worlds will look out onto a vast gaseous nebula, the remains of an ordinary star that once was and is no longer. In all those skies, rich in distant and exotic constellations, there will be a faint yellow star, perhaps barely seen by the naked eye, perhaps visible only through the telescope, the home star of the fleet of interstellar transports exploring this tiny region of the great Milky Way galaxy. The themes of space and time are, as we have seen, intertwined. Worlds and stars, like people, are born, live, and die. The lifetime of a human being is measured in decades. The lifetime of the sun is 100 million times longer. Compared to a star, we are like mayflies, fleeting, ephemeral creatures who live out their whole lives in the course of a single day. From the point of view of a mayfly, human beings are stolid, boring, almost entirely immovable, offering hardly a hint that they ever do anything. From the point of view of a star, a human being is a tiny flash, one of billions of brief lives flickering tenuously on the surface of a strangely cold, anomalously solid, exotically remote sphere of silicate and iron. In all those other worlds in space, there are events in progress, occurrences that will determine their futures. And on our small planet, this moment in history is a historical branch point, as profound as the confrontation of the Ionian scientists with the mystics 2,500 years ago. What we do with our world in this time will propagate down through the centuries and powerfully determine the destiny of our descendants and their fate, if any, among the stars. Chapter 9, The Lives of the Stars. We had the sky up there, all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them and discuss about whether they was made or only just happened. Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. I have a terrible need, shall I say the word, of religion. Then I go out at night and paint the stars. Vincent van Gogh. To make an apple pie, you need wheat, apples, a pinch of this and that, and the heat of the oven. The ingredients are made of molecules, sugar, say, or water. The molecules, in turn, are made of atoms, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and a few others. Where do these atoms come from? Except for hydrogen, they are all made in stars. A star is a kind of cosmic kitchen inside which atoms of hydrogen are cooked into heavier atoms. Stars condense from interstellar gas and dust, which are composed mostly of hydrogen. But the hydrogen was made in the Big Bang, the explosion that began the cosmos. If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Suppose you take an apple pie and cut it in half. Take one of the two pieces, cut it in half, and, in the spirit of Democritus, continue. How many cuts before you are down to a single atom? The answer is about 90 successive cuts. Of course, no knife could be sharp enough. The pie is too crumbly, and the atom would in any case be too small to see unaided. But there is a way to do it. At Cambridge University in England, in the 45 years centered on 1910, the nature of the atom was first understood, partly by shooting pieces of atoms at atoms and watching how they bounce off. A typical atom has a kind of cloud of electrons on the outside. Electrons are electrically charged, as their name suggests. The charge is arbitrarily called negative. Electrons determine the chemical properties of the atom: the glitter of gold, the cold feel of iron, the crystal structure of the carbon diamond. Deep inside the atom, hidden far beneath the electron cloud, is the nucleus, generally composed of positively charged protons and electrically neutral neutrons. Atoms are very small. 100 million of them, end to end, would be as large as the tip of your little finger. But the nucleus is 100,000 times smaller still, which is part of the reason it took so long to be discovered. Nevertheless, most of the mass of an atom is in its nucleus. The electrons are, by comparison, just clouds of moving fluff. Atoms are mainly empty space. Matter is composed chiefly of nothing. I am made of atoms. My elbow, which is resting on the table before me, is made of atoms. The table is made of atoms. But if atoms are so small and empty, and the nuclei smaller still, why does the table hold me up? Why, as Arthur Eddington liked to ask, do the nuclei that comprise my elbow not slide effortlessly through the nuclei that comprise the table? Why don't I wind up on the floor or fall straight through the earth? The answer is the electron cloud. The outside of an atom in my elbow has a negative electrical charge. So does every atom in the table. But negative charges repel each other. My elbow does not slither through the table because atoms have electrons around their nuclei and because electrical forces are strong. Everyday life depends on the structure of the atom. Turn off the electrical charges, and everything crumbles to an invisible fine dust. Without electrical forces, there would no longer be things in the universe, merely diffuse clouds of electrons, protons, and neutrons, and gravitating spheres of elementary particles, the featureless remnants of worlds. When we consider cutting an apple pie, continuing down beyond a single atom, we confront an infinity of the very small. And when we look up at the night sky, we confront an infinity of the very large. These infinities represent an unending regress that goes on not just very far, but forever. If you stand between two mirrors, in a barbershop, say, you see a large number of images of yourself, each the reflection of another. You cannot see an infinity of images because the mirrors are not perfectly flat and aligned, because light does not travel infinitely fast, and because you are in the way. When we talk about infinity, we are talking about a quantity greater than any number, no matter how large. The American mathematician, Edward Kasner, once asked his 9-year-old nephew to invent a name for an extremely large number, 10 to the power 100, 10 to the 100th power, a 1 followed by 100 zeros. The boy called it a Google. You too can make up your own very large numbers and give them strange names. Try it. It has a certain charm, especially if you happen to be 9. If a Google seems large, consider a Googleplex. It is 10 to the power of a Google, that is, a 1 followed by a Google zeros. By comparison, the total number of atoms in your body is about 10 to the 28th power. And the total number of elementary particles, protons and neutrons and electrons, in the observable universe is about 10 to the 80th power. If the universe were packed solid with neutrons, say. So there was no empty space anywhere. There would still be only about 10 to the 128th particles in it. Quite a bit more than a Google, but trivially small compared to a Googleplex. And yet, these numbers, the Google and the Googleplex, do not approach. They come nowhere near the idea of infinity. A Googleplex is precisely as far from infinity as is the number one. We could try to write out a Googleplex, but it is a forlorn ambition. A piece of paper large enough to have all the zeros in a Googleplex written out explicitly could not be stuffed into the known universe. Happily, there is a simpler and very concise way of writing a Googleplex. 10 to the 10th power to the 100th power, and even infinity. In a burnt apple pie, the char is mostly carbon. 90 cuts and you come to a carbon atom with 6 protons and 6 neutrons in its nucleus and 6 electrons in the exterior cloud. If we were to pull a chunk out of the nucleus, say one with 2 protons and 2 neutrons, it would not be the nucleus of a carbon atom, but the nucleus of a helium atom. Such a cutting or fission of atomic nuclei occurs in nuclear weapons and conventional nuclear power plants, although it is not carbon that is split. If you make the 91st cut of the apple pie, if you slice a carbon nucleus, you make not a smaller piece of carbon, but something else, an atom with completely different chemical properties. If you cut an atom, you transmute the elements. But suppose we go farther. Atoms are made of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Can we cut a proton? If we bombard protons at high energies with other elementary particles, other protons, say, we begin to glimpse more fundamental units hiding inside the proton. Physicists now propose that so-called elementary particles such as protons and neutrons are in fact made of still more elementary particles called quarks, which come in a variety of colors and flavors, as their properties have been termed in a poignant attempt to make the subnuclear world a little more like home. Are quarks the ultimate constituents of matter, or are they too composed of still smaller and more elementary particles? Will we ever come to an end in our understanding of the nature of matter, or is there an infinite regression into more and more fundamental particles? This is one of the great unsolved problems in science. The transmutation of the elements was pursued in medieval laboratories in a quest called alchemy. Many alchemists believed that all matter was a mixture of 4 elementary substances: water, air, earth, and fire, an ancient Ionian speculation. By altering the relative proportions of earth and fire, say, you would be able, they thought, to change copper into gold. The field swarmed with charming frauds and conmen, such as Cagliostro and the Count of Saint-Germain, who pretended not only to transmute the elements, but also to hold the secret of immortality. Sometimes gold was hidden in a wand with a false bottom to appear miraculously in a crucible at the end of some arduous experimental demonstration. With wealth and immortality the bait, the European nobility found itself transferring large sums to the practitioners of this dubious art. But there were more serious alchemists, such as Paracelsus and even Isaac Newton. The money was not altogether wasted. New chemical elements, such as phosphorus, antimony, and mercury, were discovered. In fact, the origin of modern chemistry can be traced directly to these experiments. There are 92 chemically distinct kinds of naturally occurring atoms. They are called the chemical elements and until recently constituted everything on our planet, although they are mainly found combined into molecules. Water is a molecule made of hydrogen and oxygen atoms. Air is made mostly of the atoms nitrogen, N, oxygen, O, carbon, C, hydrogen, H, and argon, AR. In the molecular forms N2, O2, CO2, H2O, and AR. The Earth itself is a very rich mixture of atoms, mostly silicon, oxygen, aluminum, magnesium, and iron. Fire is not made of chemical elements at all. It is a radiating plasma in which the high temperature has stripped some of the electrons from their nuclei. Not one of the four ancient Ionian and alchemical elements is in the modern sense an element at all. One is a molecule, two are mixtures of molecules, and the last is a plasma. Since the time of the alchemists, more and more elements have been discovered, the latest to be found tending to be the rarest. Many are familiar, those that primarily make up the earth, or those fundamental to life. Some are solids, some gases, and two, bromine and mercury, are liquids at room temperature. Scientists conventionally arrange them in order of complexity. The simplest, hydrogen, is element 1. The most complex, uranium, is element 92. Other elements are less familiar. Hafnium, erbium, dysprosium, and praseodymium, say, which we do not much bump into in everyday life. By and large, the more familiar an element is, the more abundant it is. The earth contains a great deal of iron and rather little yttrium. There are, of course, exceptions to this rule, such as gold or uranium, elements prized because of arbitrary economic conventions or aesthetic judgments, or because they have remarkable practical applications. The fact that atoms are composed of three kinds of elementary particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons, is a comparatively recent finding. The neutron was not discovered until 1932. Modern physics and chemistry have reduced the complexity of the sensible world to an astonishing simplicity. Three units put together in various patterns make, essentially, everything. The neutrons, as we have said, and as their name suggests, carry no electrical charge. The protons have a positive charge and the electrons an equal negative charge. The attraction between the unlike charges of electrons and protons is what holds the atom together. Since each atom is electrically neutral, the number of protons in the nucleus must exactly equal the number of electrons in the electron cloud. The chemistry of an atom depends only on the number of electrons, which equals the number of protons and which is called the atomic number. Chemistry is simply numbers, an idea Pythagoras would have liked. If you are an atom with one proton, you are hydrogen, 2, helium, 3, lithium, 4, beryllium, 5, boron, 6, carbon, 7, nitrogen, 8, oxygen, and so on, up to 92 protons, in which case your name is uranium. Like charges, charges of the same sign, strongly repel one another. We can think of it as a dedicated mutual aversion to their own kind, a little as if the world were densely populated by anchorites and misanthropes. Electrons repel electrons. Protons repel protons. So how can a nucleus stick together? Why does it not instantly fly apart? Because there is another force of nature, not gravity, not electricity, but the short-range nuclear force, which, like a set of hooks that engage only when protons and neutrons come very close together, thereby overcomes the electrical repulsion among the protons. The neutrons, which contribute nuclear forces of attraction and no electrical forces of repulsion, provide a kind of glue that helps to hold the nucleus together. Longing for solitude, the hermits have been chained to their grumpy fellows and set among others given to indiscriminate and voluble amiability. Two protons and two neutrons are the nucleus of a helium atom, which turns out to be very stable. Three helium nuclei make a carbon nucleus. 4, oxygen. 5, neon. 6, magnesium. 7, silicon. 8, sulfur, and so on. Every time we add one or more protons and enough neutrons to keep the nucleus together, we make a new chemical element. If we subtract one proton and three neutrons from mercury, we make gold, the dream of the ancient alchemists. Beyond uranium, there are other elements that do not naturally occur on Earth. They are synthesized by human beings and in most cases promptly fall to pieces. One of them, element 94, is called plutonium and is one of the most toxic substances known. Unfortunately, it falls to pieces rather slowly. Where do the naturally occurring elements come from? We might contemplate a separate creation of each atomic species, but the universe, all of it, almost everywhere, is 99% hydrogen and helium, the two simplest elements. Helium, in fact, was detected on the sun before it was found on the Earth, hence its name, from Helios, one of the Greek sun gods. Might the other chemical elements have somehow evolved from hydrogen and helium? To balance the electrical repulsion, pieces of nuclear matter would have to be brought very close together so that the short-range nuclear forces are engaged. This can happen only at very high temperatures, where the particles are moving so fast that the repulsive force does not have time to act, temperatures of tens of millions of degrees. In nature, such high temperatures and attendant high pressures are common only in the insides of the stars. We have examined our sun, the nearest star, in various wavelengths, from radio waves to ordinary visible light to X-rays, all of which arise only from its outermost layers. It is not exactly a red-hot stone, as Anaxagoras thought, but rather a great ball of hydrogen and helium gas, glowing because of its high temperatures in the same way that a poker glows when it is brought to red heat. Anaxagoras was at least partly right. Violent solar storms produce brilliant flares that disrupt radio communications on Earth, and immense arching plumes of hot gas guided by the sun's magnetic field, the solar prominences, which dwarf the Earth. The sunspots, sometimes visible to the naked eye at sunset, are cooler regions of enhanced magnetic field strength. All this incessant roiling, turbulent activity is in the comparatively cool, visible surface. We see only to temperatures of about 6,000 degrees, but the hidden interior of the sun, where sunlight is being generated, is at 40 million degrees. Stars and their accompanying planets are born in the gravitational collapse of a cloud of interstellar gas and dust. The collision of the gas molecules in the interior of the cloud heats it, eventually, to the point where hydrogen begins to fuse into helium. Four hydrogen nuclei combine to form a helium nucleus with an attendant release of a gamma ray photon. Suffering alternate absorption and emission by the overlying matter, gradually working its way toward the surface of the star, losing energy, at every step, the photon's epic journey takes a million years until, as visible light, it reaches the surface and is radiated to space. The star has turned on. The gravitational collapse of the prestellar cloud has been halted. The weight of the outer layers of the star is now supported by the high temperatures and pressures generated in the interior nuclear reactions. The sun has been in such a stable situation for the past 5 billion years. Thermonuclear reactions like those in a hydrogen bomb are powering the sun in a contained and continuous explosion, converting some 400 million tons of hydrogen into helium every second. When we look up at night and view the stars, everything we see is shining because of distant nuclear fusion. In the direction of the star Deneb, in the constellation of Cygnus, the Swan, is an enormous glowing superbubble of extremely hot gas, probably produced by supernova explosions, the deaths of stars near the center of the bubble. At the periphery, interstellar matter is compressed by the supernova shockwave, triggering new generations of cloud collapse and star formation. In this sense, stars have parents and, as is sometimes also true for humans, a parent may die in the birth of the child. Stars, like the sun, are born in batches, in great compressed cloud complexes, such as the Orion Nebula. Seen from the outside, such clouds seem dark and gloomy, but inside, they are brilliantly illuminated by the hot newborn stars. Later, the stars wander out of their nursery to seek their fortunes in the Milky Way, stellar adolescents still surrounded by tufts of glowing nebulosity, residues still gravitationally attached of their amniotic gas. The Pleiades are a nearby example. As in the families of humans, the maturing stars journey far from home, and the siblings see little of each other. Somewhere in the galaxy, there are stars, perhaps dozens of them, that are the brothers and sisters of the sun, formed from the same cloud complex some 5 billion years ago. But we do not know which stars they are. They may, for all we know, be on the other side of the Milky Way. The conversion of hydrogen into helium in the center of the sun not only accounts for the sun's brightness in photons of visible light, it also produces a radiance of a more mysterious and ghostly kind. The sun glows faintly in neutrinos, which, like photons, weigh nothing and travel at the speed of light. But neutrinos are not photons. They are not a kind of light. Neutrinos, like protons, electrons, and neutrons, carry an intrinsic angular momentum, or spin, while photons have no spin at all. Matter is transparent to neutrinos, which pass almost effortlessly through the Earth and through the Sun. Only a tiny fraction of them is stopped by the intervening matter. As I look up at the Sun for a second, a billion neutrinos pass through my eyeball. Of course, they are not stopped at the retina, as ordinary photons are, but continue unmolested through the back of my head. The curious part is that if at night I look down at the ground, toward the place where the sun would be if the Earth were not in the way, almost exactly the same number of solar neutrinos pass through my eyeball, pouring through an interposed Earth which is as transparent to neutrinos as a pane of clear glass is to visible light. If our knowledge of the solar interior is as complete as we think, and if we also understand the nuclear physics that makes neutrinos, then we should be able to calculate with fair accuracy how many solar neutrinos we should receive in a given area, such as my eyeball, in a given unit of time, such as a second. Experimental confirmation of the calculation is much more difficult. Since neutrinos pass directly through the Earth, we cannot catch a given one. But for a vast number of neutrinos, a small fraction will interact with matter and, in the appropriate circumstances, might be detected. Neutrinos can, on rare occasion, convert chlorine atoms into argon atoms with the same total number of protons and neutrons. To detect the predicted solar neutrino flux, you need an immense amount of chlorine. So American physicists have poured a huge quantity of cleaning fluid into the Homestake mine in Leeds, South Dakota. The chlorine is microchemically swept for the newly produced argon. The more argon found, the more neutrinos inferred. These experiments imply that the sun is dimmer in neutrinos than the calculations predict. There is a real and unsolved mystery here. The low solar neutrino flux probably does not put our view of stellar nucleosynthesis in jeopardy, but it surely means something important. Proposed explanations range from the hypothesis that neutrinos fall to pieces during their passage between the Sun and the Earth, to the idea that the nuclear fires in the solar interior are temporarily banked, sunlight being generated in our time partly by slow gravitational contraction. But neutrino astronomy is very new. For the moment, we stand amazed at having created a tool that can peer directly into the blazing heart of the sun. As the sensitivity of the neutrino telescope improves, it may become possible to probe nuclear fusion in the deep interiors of the nearby stars. But hydrogen fusion cannot continue forever. In the sun or any other star, there is only so much hydrogen fuel in its hot interior. The fate of a star, the end of its life cycle, depends very much on its initial mass. If, after whatever matter it has lost to space, a star retains 2 or 3 times the mass of the sun, It ends its life cycle in a startlingly different mode than the sun. But the sun's fate is spectacular enough. When the central hydrogen has all reacted to form helium 5 or 6 billion years from now, the zone of hydrogen fusion will slowly migrate outward, an expanding shell of thermonuclear reactions, until it reaches the place where the temperatures are less than about 10 million degrees. Then, hydrogen fusion will shut itself off. Meanwhile, the self-gravity of the sun will force a renewed contraction of its helium-rich core and a further increase in its interior temperatures and pressures. The helium nuclei will be jammed together still more tightly, so much so that they begin to stick together, the hooks of their short-range nuclear forces becoming engaged despite the mutual electrical repulsion. The ash will become fuel, and the sun will be triggered into a second round of fusion reactions. This process will generate the elements carbon and oxygen and provide additional energy for the sun to continue shining for a limited time. A star is a phoenix, destined to rise for a time from its own ashes. Under the combined influence of hydrogen fusion in a thin shell far from the solar interior, and the high-temperature helium fusion in the core, the sun will undergo a major change. Its exterior will expand and cool. The sun will become a red giant star, its visible surface so far from its interior that the gravity at its surface grows feeble, its atmosphere expanding into space in a kind of stellar gale. When the sun, ruddy and bloated, becomes a red giant, it will envelop and devour the planets Mercury and Venus, and probably the Earth as well. The inner solar system will then reside within the sun. Billions of years from now, there will be a last perfect day on Earth. Thereafter, the sun will slowly become red and distended, presiding over an Earth sweltering, even at the poles. The Arctic and Antarctic ice caps will melt, flooding the coasts of the world. The high oceanic temperatures will release more water vapor into the air, increasing cloudiness, shielding the Earth from sunlight and delaying the end a little. But solar evolution is inexorable. Eventually, the oceans will boil, the atmosphere will evaporate away to space, and a catastrophe of the most immense proportions imaginable will overtake our planet. In the meantime, human beings will almost certainly have evolved into something quite different. Perhaps our descendants will be able to control or moderate stellar evolution, or perhaps they will merely pick up and leave for Mars or Europa or Titan or, at last, as Robert Goddard envisioned, seek out an uninhabited planet in some young and promising planetary system. The sun's stellar ash can be reused for fuel only up to a point. Eventually, the time will come when the solar interior is all carbon and oxygen, when at the prevailing temperatures and pressures, no further nuclear reactions can occur. After the central helium is almost all used up, the interior of the sun will continue its postponed collapse. The temperatures will rise again, triggering a last round of nuclear reactions and expanding the solar atmosphere a little. In its death throes, the sun will slowly pulsate, expanding and contracting once every few millennia, eventually spewing its atmosphere into space in one or more concentric shells of gas. The hot, exposed solar interior will flood the shell with ultraviolet light, inducing a lovely red and blue fluorescence extending beyond the orbit of Pluto. Perhaps half the mass of the sun will be lost in this way. The solar system will then be filled with an eerie radiance, the ghost of the sun, outward bound. When we look around us in our little corner of the Milky Way, we see many stars surrounded by spherical shells of glowing gas, the planetary nebulae. They have nothing to do with the planets, but some of them seemed reminiscent in inferior telescopes of the blue-green disks of Uranus and Neptune. They appear as rings, but only because, as with soap bubbles, we see more of them at the periphery than at the center. Every planetary nebula is a token of a star in extremis. Near the central star, there may be a retinue of dead worlds, the remnants of planets once full of life and now airless and ocean-free, bathed in a wraith-like luminance. The remains of the Sun, the exposed solar core at first enveloped in its planetary nebula, will be a small, hot star cooling to space, collapsed to a density unheard of on Earth, more than a ton per teaspoonful. Billions of years hence, the Sun will become a degenerate white dwarf, cooling like all those points of light we see at the centers of planetary nebulae, from high surface temperatures to its ultimate state, a dark and dead black dwarf. Two stars of roughly the same mass will evolve roughly in parallel, but a more massive star will spend its nuclear fuel faster, become a red giant sooner, and be first to enter the final white dwarf decline. There should therefore be, as there are, many cases of binary stars, one component a red giant, the other a white dwarf. Some such pairs are so close together that they touch, and the glowing stellar atmosphere flows from the distended red giant to the compact white dwarf, tending to fall on a particular province of the surface of the white dwarf. The hydrogen accumulates, compressed to higher and higher pressures and temperatures by the intense gravity of the white dwarf, until the stolen atmosphere of the red giant undergoes thermonuclear reactions, and the white dwarf briefly flares into brilliance. Such a binary is called a nova and has quite a different origin from a supernova. Novae occur only in binary systems and are powered by hydrogen fusion. Supernovae occur in single stars and are powered by silicon fusion. Atoms synthesized in the interiors of stars are commonly returned to the interstellar gas. Red giants find their outer atmospheres blowing away into space. Planetary nebulae are the final stages of sun-like stars blowing their tops. Supernovae violently eject much of their stellar mass into space. The atoms returned are, naturally, those most readily made in the thermonuclear reactions in stellar interiors. Hydrogen fuses into helium, helium into carbon, carbon into oxygen, and thereafter, in massive stars, by the successive addition of further helium nuclei, neon, magnesium, silicon, sulfur, and so on, are built. Additions by stages, two protons and two neutrons per stage, all the way to iron. Direct fusion of silicon also generates iron. A pair of silicon atoms, each with 28 protons and neutrons, joining at a temperature of billions of degrees to make an atom of iron with 56 protons and neutrons. These are all familiar chemical elements. We recognize their names. Such stellar nuclear reactions do not readily generate erbium, hafnium, dysprosium, praseodymium, or yttrium, but rather the elements we know in everyday life, elements returned to the interstellar gas, where they are swept up in a subsequent generation of cloud collapse and star and planet formation. All the elements of the Earth, except hydrogen and some helium, have been cooked by a kind of stellar alchemy billions of years ago in stars, some of which are today inconspicuous white dwarfs on the other side of the Milky Way galaxy. The nitrogen in our DNA, the calcium in our teeth, the iron in our blood, the carbon in our apple pies were made in the interiors of collapsing stars. We are made of star stuff. Some of the rarer elements are generated in the supernova explosion itself. We have relatively abundant gold and uranium on Earth only because many supernova explosions had occurred just before the solar system formed. Other planetary systems may have somewhat different amounts of our rare elements. Are there planets where the inhabitants proudly display pendants of niobium and bracelets of protactinium, while gold is a laboratory curiosity? Would our lives be improved if gold and uranium were as obscure and unimportant on Earth as praseodymium The origin and evolution of life are connected in the most intimate way with the origin and evolution of the stars. First, the very matter of which we are composed, the atoms that make life possible, were generated long ago and far away in giant red stars. The relative abundance of the chemical elements found in the cosmos matches the relative abundance of atoms generated in stars so well as to leave little doubt that red giants and supernovae are the ovens and crucibles in which matter has been forged. The Sun is a second or third generation star. All the matter in it, all the matter you see around you, has been through one or two previous cycles of stellar alchemy. Second, the existence of certain varieties of heavy atoms on the Earth suggests that there was a nearby supernova explosion shortly before the solar system was formed. But this is unlikely to be a mere coincidence. More likely, the shockwave produced by the supernova compressed interstellar gas and dust and triggered the condensation of the solar system. Third, when the Sun turned on, its ultraviolet radiation poured into the atmosphere of the Earth. Its warmth generated lightning, and these energy sources sparked the complex organic molecules that led to the origin of life. Fourth, life on Earth runs almost exclusively on sunlight. Plants gather the photons and convert solar to chemical energy. Animals parasitize the plants. Farming is simply the methodical harvesting of sunlight using plants as grudging intermediaries. We are, almost all of us, solar-powered. Finally, the hereditary changes called mutations provide the raw material for evolution. Mutations, from which nature selects its new inventory of life forms, are produced in part by cosmic rays, high-energy particles ejected almost at the speed of light in supernova explosions. The evolution of life on Earth is driven in part by the spectacular deaths of distant, massive suns. Imagine carrying a Geiger counter and a piece of uranium ore to some place deep beneath the Earth, a gold mine, say, or a lava tube, a cave carved through the Earth by a river of molten rock. The sensitive counter clicks when exposed to gamma rays or to such high-energy charged particles as protons and helium nuclei. If we bring it close to the uranium ore, which is emitting helium nuclei in a spontaneous nuclear decay, the count rate, the number of clicks per minute, increases dramatically. If we drop the uranium ore into a heavy lead canister, the count rate declines substantially. The lead has absorbed the uranium radiation, but some clicks can still be heard. Of the remaining counts, a fraction come from natural radioactivity in the walls of the cave, but there are more clicks than can be accounted for by radioactivity. Some of them are caused by high-energy charged particles penetrating the roof. We are listening to cosmic rays produced in another age in the depths of space. Cosmic rays, mainly electrons and protons, have bombarded the Earth for the entire history of life on our planet. A star destroys itself thousands of light years away and produces cosmic rays that spiral through the Milky Way galaxy for millions of years until, quite by accident, some of them strike the Earth and our hereditary material. Perhaps some key steps in the development of the genetic code, or Cambrian explosion, or bipedal stature among our ancestors were initiated by cosmic rays. On July 4th, in the year 1054, Chinese astronomers recorded what they called a guest star in the constellation of Taurus the Bull. A star never before seen became brighter than any star in the sky. Halfway around the world, in the American Southwest, there was then a high culture rich in astronomical tradition that also witnessed this brilliant new star. From carbon-14 dating of the remains of a charcoal fire, we know that in the middle 11th century, some Anasazi, the antecedents of the Hopi of today, were living under an overhanging ledge in what is today New Mexico. One of them seems to have drawn on the cliff overhang, protected from the weather, a picture of the new star. Its position relative to the crescent moon would have been just as was depicted. There is also a handprint, perhaps the artist's signature. This remarkable star, 5,000 light-years distant, is now called the Crab Supernova because an astronomer, centuries later, was unaccountably reminded of a crab when looking at the explosion remnant through his telescope. The Crab Nebula is the remains of a massive star that blew itself up. The explosion was seen on Earth with the naked eye for 3 months. Easily visible in broad daylight, you could read by it at night. On the average, a supernova occurs in a given galaxy about once every century. During the lifetime of a typical galaxy, about 10 billion years, 100 million stars will have exploded, a great many, but still only about one star in 1,000. In the Milky Way, after the event of 1054, there was a supernova observed in 1572 and described by Tycho Brahe, and another just after in 1604 described by Johannes Kepler. Unhappily, no supernova explosions have been observed in our galaxy since the invention of the telescope, and astronomers have been chafing at the bit for some centuries. Supernovae are now routinely observed in other galaxies. Among my candidates for the sentence that would most thoroughly astonish an astronomer of the early 1900s is the following, from a paper by David Helfand and Knox Long in the December 6, 1979 issue of the British journal Nature. On 5 March 1979, an extremely intense burst of hard X-rays and gamma rays was recorded by the 9 interplanetary spacecraft of the Burst Sensor Network and localized by time-of-flight determinations to a position coincident with the supernova remnant N49 in the Large Magellanic Cloud. The Large Magellanic Cloud, so-called because the first inhabitant of the Northern Hemisphere to notice it was Magellan, is a small satellite galaxy of the Milky Way, 180,000 light-years distant. There is also, as you might expect, a small Magellanic Cloud. However, in the same issue of Nature, E.P. Mazitz and colleagues of the IOFI Institute, Leningrad, who observed this source with the gamma-ray burst detector aboard the Venera 11 and 12 spacecraft on their way to land on Venus, argue that what is being seen is a flaring pulsar only a few hundred light-years away. But despite the close agreement in position, Helfand and Long do not insist that the gamma-ray outburst is associated with the supernova remnant. They charitably consider many alternatives, including the surprising possibility that the source lies within the solar system. Perhaps it is the exhaust of an alien starship on its long voyage home. But arousing of the stellar fires in N49 is a simpler hypothesis. We are sure there are such things as supernovae. The fate of the inner solar system as the sun becomes a red giant is grim enough. But at least the planets will never be melted and frizzled by an erupting supernova. That is a fate reserved for planets near stars more massive than the sun. Since such stars with higher temperatures and pressures run rapidly through their store of nuclear fuel, their lifetimes are much shorter than the sun's. A star tens of times more massive than the sun can stably convert hydrogen to helium for only a few million years before moving briefly onto more exotic nuclear reactions. Thus, there is almost certainly not enough time for the evolution of advanced forms of life on any accompanying planets, and it will be rare that beings elsewhere can ever know that their star will become a supernova. If they live long enough to understand supernovae, their star is unlikely to become one. The essential preliminary to a supernova explosion is the generation by silicon fusion of a massive iron core. Under enormous pressure, the free electrons in the stellar interior are forcibly melded with the protons of the iron nuclei, the equal and opposite electrical charges, K canceling each other out. The inside of the star is turned into a single, giant atomic nucleus, occupying a much smaller volume than the precursor electrons and iron nuclei. The core implodes violently. The exterior rebounds, and a supernova explosion results. A supernova can be brighter than the combined radiance of all the other stars in the galaxy within which it is embedded. All those recently hatched, massive blue-white supergiant stars in Orion are destined in the next few million years to become supernovae, the continuing cosmic fireworks in the constellation of the Hunter. The awesome supernova explosion ejects into space most of the matter of the precursor star, a little residual hydrogen and helium, and significant amounts of other atoms, carbon and silicon, iron and uranium. Remaining is a core of hot neutrons bound together by nuclear forces, a single massive atomic nucleus with an atomic weight about 10 to the 56th power, a sun 30 kilometers across, a tiny, shrunken, dense, withered stellar fragment, a rapidly rotating neutron star. As the core of a massive red giant collapses to form such a neutron star, it spins faster. The neutron star at the center of the Crab Nebula is an immense atomic nucleus, about the size of Manhattan, spinning 30 times a second. Its powerful magnetic field, amplified during the collapse, traps charged particles rather as the much tinier magnetic field of Jupiter does. Electrons in the rotating magnet field emit beamed radiation, not only at radio frequencies, but in visible light as well. If the Earth happens to lie in the beam of this cosmic lighthouse, we see it flash once each rotation. This is the reason it is called a pulsar. Blinking and ticking like a cosmic metronome, pulsars keep far better time than the most accurate ordinary clock. Long-term timing of the radio pulse rate of some pulsars, for instance, one called PSR 0329 plus 54, suggests that these objects may have one or more small planetary companions. It is perhaps conceivable that a planet could survive the evolution of a star into a pulsar, or a planet could be captured at a later time. I wonder how the sky would look from the surface of such a planet. Neutron star matter weighs about the same as an ordinary mountain per teaspoonful, so much that if you had a piece of it and let it go, you could hardly do otherwise. It might pass effortlessly through the Earth like a falling stone through air, carving a hole for itself completely through our planet and emerging out the other side, perhaps in China. People there might be out for a stroll, minding their own business, when a tiny lump of neutron star plummets out of the ground, hovers for a moment, and then returns beneath the Earth, providing at least a diversion from the routine of the day. If a piece of neutron star matter were dropped from nearby space, with the Earth rotating beneath it as it fell, it would plunge repeatedly through the rotating Earth, punching hundreds of thousands of holes before friction with the interior of our planet stopped the motion. Before it comes to rest at the center of the Earth, the inside of our planet might look briefly like a Swiss cheese until the subterranean flow of rock and metal healed the wounds. It is just as well that large lumps of neutron star matter are unknown on Earth. But small lumps are everywhere. The awesome power of the neutron star is lurking in the nucleus of every atom, hidden in every teacup and dormouse, every breath of air, every apple pie. The neutron star teaches us respect for the commonplace. A star, like the sun, will end its days as we have seen as a red giant and then a white dwarf. A collapsing star, twice as massive as the sun, will become a supernova and then a neutron star. But a more massive star, left after its supernova phase with, say, five times the sun's mass, has an even more remarkable fate reserved for it. Its gravity will turn it into a black hole. Suppose we had a magic gravity machine. a device with which we could control the Earth's gravity, perhaps by turning a dial. Initially, the dial is set at 1G, and everything behaves